Alcoholic as well, double winner. I had the privilege and honor to meet our speaker today at the airport and have lunch with him and have some good conversation and share some jokes and stories and just had a wonderful time this morning. And what I can say about Bob is that from what I hear and what I've seen in his life so far, he is proof that this program works and is a real good Al-Anon. So with that, I give you our speaker, Bob S.
I thought I'd charge Charlie's battery up a little, the taper. I want to thank all the people who made it possible for me to be here. You've been so good to me, and I just had a wonderful time. You know, I was supposed to be here last year and caught pneumonia in Vancouver, B.C., and couldn't make it. So I'm here now, and I'm so glad Fran and Rick have taken such good care of me. Tom's been my host, and I don't know who picked the speakers, but I'll tell you, you picked a bunch of dandies. This, you are in for a treat. What people, some of them are, they're friends of mine, and I happen to have been on programs with them, so hang in there for the whole thing. It's going to be wonderful. My name is Bob S., and I'm an enthusiastic member of Al-Anon. I started this journey with you in April of 79. And I got into Al-Anon not because of my parents, but because of my wife. My wife, Betty, who died 5 years ago, was a recovering alcoholic, 19 years sober when she died. And she came into AA, and then I came into Al-Anon. And that's how I got here. I think that there's some things that I must do to be in Al-Anon. I don't think you're automatically in Al-Anon. I think you have to do some work on your part. I think I need to live the steps. I think I need to abide by the tradition. I think I need to attend meetings regularly. And I think I need to have a sponsor. And I do those things. When I came in 24 years ago, the only guy, Al-Anon, was about the age of my son, and I didn't think we had too much going. So I selected a lady even older than I, and she's been my service sponsor ever since. Now, I know we do not encourage sponsors of the opposite sex, but you can tell by looking at me it's not a very serious problem. Now, don't misunderstand me, please. I love to see you beautiful ladies. I just can't remember why. I hope we have a happy time together. You know, these are happy programs. And all my sponsor goaded me into service. You know, service is one part of our triangle. And I've been the GR and the DR. And I served 3 years with the West Texas Assembly. And several years ago, I got a call from our central office asking me if I would consider myself to be a candidate for trustee at large for all of Al-Anon. And I seemed to have the educational qualifications for which they searched. And I prayed about it and talked to my group about it and called them back and said, yeah, please, put my name down. I'd love to be a candidate for trustee at large for all of Al-Anon. And guess what? I didn't get it. Hell no, we hate rejection. But the point I want to make is my program came in, kicked in, and said, hey, whoever got that job was the one that they really needed, capable of doing a much better job than you. And maybe our Heavenly Father has something else for me to do. And I'm totally free of that. totally free of that. And that's part of our acceptance that we learn in our program. Beautiful acceptance. Although I have only been a member of Al-Anon 24 years, I am somewhat of an anachronism. I'm the only person still living that was present when the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous met for the very first time, Mother's Day, Akron, Ohio. My dad, Dr. Bob, and my mom's Ann. I rode out with my parents to meet with Bill at the home of Henrietta Seiberling. And as a result of that meeting, and at my mom's invitation, Bill came and he lived at our house all that summer. Now I'm the only one left standing, and it's kind of scary, you know. Bill's gone, Lois is gone, my dad's gone, mom's gone, my beautiful, beloved sister Sue died over a year ago. So I'm the only one left. And to show you I'm not completely well, the thought has occurred to me, nobody can say, now, Bob, that's not the way it happened. I even thought I might adjust history a little bit. No, I'm not going to do it. But anyway, I'd like to take you back with me in my memory of those days and when AA started. And I'm so glad that somebody mentioned my mom. I'm going to talk about my mom tonight, too. My dad, Dr. Bob, was a graduate of Dartmouth, one of the fine Ivy League colleges back in the East. And he worked out in industry about 3 years. And then went back and to medical school, kicked out of the first one, made the second one, moved to Akron, Ohio, and married my mom after a whirlwind courtship of only 17 years. Dr. Bob thought things over very carefully. Last week I was in Dartmouth. They are celebrating their most illustrious alum, which I think is great because he sure as heck wasn't their most illustrious alum when he was going to school. But they are dedicating some things to him, and I'm just delighted over that. Dr. Bob was a tall, thin Vermonter, icy blue eyes that kind of could look right through you. His pictures, he looked so grim, but he wasn't that way at all. He was a happy guy and fun to be around. And when I brought my bride-to-be home for the folks to look over in the 1940s, my wife was tall and slender, and he looked her over and got me aside and said, she's built for speed and light housekeeping. And it... Excuse me, a section hygiene lecture to me as a teenager got me up in the bathroom one day and closed the door, and I thought, oh, I'm going to find out all about it now. He said to me, flies spread disease, keep yours buttoned. He was the best sport and just fun to be around. He wanted to go back to his beloved Vermont one time, and he had some sort of an old car. It was in the Depression that didn't run very well and used a lot of gasoline. And I had bought a Ford Roadster for less than $30. And the reason I got it for less than $30 is I didn't get the top with it. And he said, do you think that old Ford will run to Vermont and then up into Canada? And I said, yeah, I think so, Dad. It runs great. I said, but what are we going to do when it rains? He said, we're going to get wet. And a high school friend of mine and Dad toured all through New England, that old Ford, just had a wonderful time. You know, Bill was also a tall, thin Vermonter. Born within 100 miles of each other, my dad at St. Johnsbury and Bill at East Dorset. And total opposite. Absolutely total opposites. Bill was garrulous. Bill loved to talk. Bill was a visitor. When Bill came to conduct a meeting, you were going to be there a while. And Bill was a visionary. I think Bill Wilson could see further up the road than any human I've ever known. But Bill's mood swung. He was either high as a Georgia pine or low as a snake. He never really leveled off. My dad pretty well run along on an even keel. And these two guys fit together perfectly. And again, I think perhaps it was providentially arranged. Never had an argument. And even though they're total opposites, I think that was necessary. Two kids, you know, folks, if any two of us are exactly alike, one of us is unnecessary. Well, I rode out with my dad and mom, and my dad had terrible hangovers. And he said as we went along, okay, 15 minutes of this bird is all I want. But, folks, it wasn't 15 minutes. He and Bill went off in a room by themselves, and they talked for many hours. And as a result of that meeting, and at my mom's invitation, Bill came and he lived at our house all that summer. And this is a time and place that Alcoholics Anonymous was formulated. I love your theme, miracles. These programs are just, I can talk to you about miracles almost indefinitely. All the wonderful things that have happened, even at the very start. You know, when Roland Hazard went and talked to Carl Jung, and we've read about that. Do you know Carl Jung was the only one of the three famous psychiatrists that believed in God? The other two were sworn atheists. If he'd have gone to one of the other two, that idea about a spiritual awakening never would have been broached. And that's the very first. And another one, of course, was, Mom didn't say, come over, Bill, and have soup with us. She said, come live with us. Now, this is, Bill lived in New York, and we lived in Akron, Ohio, you know, never had seen a guy before. And I'll tell you another miracle. Bill said, okay. So he moved in. My mom wrote to Lois, Bill's wife, our beloved Al-Anon co-founder. And Lois came and stayed with us as long as she could. Remember, this is the Depression. Lois was the only one that had a job. And she had to get back to New York and get to work. What did these two guys have going for them? The only thing I could think of, they both had open spiritual minds, and they had the desire to be of service to another human being. And the first one I remember was a young guy by the name of Eddie. Eddie had just been thrown out of his house for non-payment of rent, along with a cute little blonde wife and two stair-step kids. Well, they moved the whole family into our house. We still had a house, just barely. Took Eddie upstairs and locked him in the upstairs where he'd be available as they got this knowledge. And hey, you got to remember, nothing's written. They're just trying to stay a page ahead of Eddie. But Eddie was an agile young guy, and we had downspouts. And Eddie would open the second-story window, slide down the downspouts, and escape. And they had to postpone Eddie's recovery long enough to recapture him. Can you imagine a more inauspicious start to a wonderful movement? One time, Eddie got as far away as Cleveland, Ohio. Called him up on the phone, collect, to let them know that he was going to commit suicide. But that he would give them time to drive up and witness the event. Well, they brought Eddie back one more time. But when Eddie sobered up, he had some mental problems that hadn't surfaced. And he began beating up on this little lady to whom he was married. And then he began chasing my mom around the house with a butcher knife. So we held a group conscience meeting. And you know, it was decided the only thing to do with Eddie was for his little wife to take him back to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and recommit him in a mental institution. And this was done, and Bill and Dad were crestfallen. Here's their first attempt to sober up another alcoholic. Total failure. But I want to tell you folks something. At my dad's funeral 15 years later, a guy walked up to me, and he said, did you know me? Do you know me? And I looked at him, and I said, yeah, you're Eddie. And he said, that's right. And he said, I want you to know I'm a member of the Youngstown, Ohio AA group, and I've been sober 1 year. So we don't know the result of that 12-step call. Our problem is to take that hand that reaches out for help. That's our part of it. I think the results depend upon perhaps the interest of the person receiving the message and the will of our Heavenly Father. But our part is to take that hand that reaches out for help. I want to talk to you today about starting from nothing, because AA certainly did start from nothing. No money. These two guys couldn't raise $50 between them. And I want to talk to you about miracles, and I want to talk to you about recovery. I'm not going into what it used to be like. I don't know. I'm going on the basic premise that everyone here already knows how to be miserable. Okay. I love to hear people talk about recovery. Of course, the man on the bed, as you saw, that was Ernie G. I mean, Bill Dodson. And, you know, Bill's story is not in the first edition of the Big Book. Do you know why? We're not all completely well. Bill wanted to get paid for it, and they wouldn't pay him. It's in the later editions, but it's not in the first edition. But anyhow, Bill was the first success that these two had, and Bill never took another drink. Bill was a Southern attorney, and of course, their first convert. It just went along as just a sort of a trickle. And we began taking alcoholics into our home because nobody had any money. Hospital beds were very expensive. A double is like $16 a day. I think they're up a little now, but nobody had any money, so we began taking them into our home. And my sister and I were teenagers. So now we'd been living first 17 years of our lives with active alcoholism. Were any of you here like me raised in an alcoholic home? Raise your arms, will you? Oh, wow. Let me touch on that just a minute. I think we arrive at adulthood with some scars. I don't doubt that. But I think that through the learning that I've got from the program, that there are some things I must guard against. I think I must totally avoid the victim mindset. You know, all my screw-ups, all the bad things I did, all the things I was supposed to do and didn't do, they weren't my fault, you see, because I'm a victim of somebody else's alcoholism. Well, that works. That works. But to keep that victim mindset going, there's one thing that I would have to do. I have to continually and increasingly resent somebody, some group, some action, some place. And we all know in our program the one thing that will totally destroy us is resentment. So I like to think of myself as a survivor, not a victim, but as a survivor. Well, when we got into recovery, oh, this was fun. Can you imagine two teenagers around a house full of live drunks? Boy, it was... It was peppy. We never knew what was going to happen. Dad and Bill had devised a treatment, standard treatment. Dad would take a new guy upstairs in the house and say, okay, fella, I'm going to give you a little shot of whiskey, but I want you to take this medicine. And it was pyraldehyde. Yeah, I can tell some of you smelt pyraldehyde. Very pungent sedative. He knocked them out from 24 to 36 hours. And when the guy came down, they had the food diet to settle the nerves and get the mind going again. And it was standard. Canned tomatoes, sauerkraut. Yeah, Bill had an ulcer, and he thought sauerkraut cured everything. And Cairo syrup. I think you'll agree the early alcoholics were a hardy group. Remember that my mom was the one that invited Bill to live with us. Mom was the one who was making the beds. Mom was the one that's cleaning up the messes. Mom's the one that was cooking the food. Mom's the one that's on the telephone answering the inquiries and sending these new guys out. Now, I want to tell you about Mom because nobody knows much about her, and maybe she wanted it that way. But Mom was a graduate of Wellesley, one of the fine women's colleges back in the East, and she went there on a scholarship. And her great uncle was the president of the Santa Fe Railroad. And in those days, the president of the railroad had his own opulent rail car, could tie onto trains wherever trains went. And he liked my mother and would take her with him on some of these. So she got to see the genteel, opulent side of life. And Mom was a school teacher, had led a very sheltered and protected life, and was very easily shocked until AA. Now, Mom's the one that's enduring the snubs. You know, AA wasn't an instant success. It was thought as a cult and a bunch of nuts. And we weren't at all popular with the neighbors. If you want to get a feel for that, start a halfway house in your home. But we even got kicked out of the Presbyterian Church on account of AA. And I never heard of anyone getting kicked out of the Presbyterian Church, but we were. So this poor lady endured all of that, and I love to tell about her. Mom took up smoking when she was 50. I said, Mom, you're not going to start smoking now, are you? And she said, I'll tell you what, if you wait till you're 50, I won't say anything. Well, as an economy measure, remember times were tough, we didn't have any money. Mom decided to buy a Target machine to make your own cigarettes. I don't know if any of you have ever seen one, but it's a little metal deal. You put the paper in, sprinkle the tobacco, took the lever, rolled it over and back, and you had a cigarette. Well, Susie, my sister, and I thought this was a little beneath our dignity, so we volunteered to make her some. But instead of tobacco, we used shavings out of the pencil sharpener. Well, when she lit the first one, of course, the fire didn't go out. And after a while, she said, you know, these aren't nearly as good as those Lucky Strikes. Mom insisted that everyone that stay there have a quiet time, that they might feel near to God. Mom also started a women's group in 1936 for the wives of alcoholics, whereby in her loving way she tried to teach them patience, love, and tolerance. So Mom realized from the word go that this was an illness that affected not only the alcoholic, but those close to him. And you know, when Lois, Bill's wife, our beloved co-founder, decided in 1950 to see if there was an interest in an organization like Al-Anon, she wrote to all the known AA groups around the country to see if anybody was interested. And to her surprise, she found out there were 64 groups already doing it. Independent thinking. They decided that it was something and they were doing it their way. So it's always been an illness that affected the whole family. Mom always sat in the back of the room. All the earlier meetings were open meetings. And she sat in the back of the room and she greeted everybody that came in. And always wore the same old black dress. It was the only decent dress she had for years. And when Dad got back on his feet financially, Mom got three brand new dresses. And somebody said, Ann, you going to wear a new dress to the meeting tonight? And she said, oh, no, I'm going to wear the old black dress. There'll be somebody come through those doors that can't afford a new dress. And that was my mom. Well, Mom died in 1949. I attended the first international in 1950. My dad was terminally ill. This is the one where they adopted the 12 traditions of AA. Six guys got up and they each read two of the traditions. And this is, the longer I'm around these programs, the more I realize this is the glue that holds us together, folks, these 12 traditions. And if you stop and analyze them, they're a beautiful, beautiful, miraculous example of damage control. Anticipating all the things that might destroy the movement. Damage control. Miraculous. How about this one? We're self-supporting through our own contribution. In the early days, the liquor industry wanted to give AA big money. Yeah, because as a PR Some, and though they were terribly broke, they resisted that. Because, you see, there would have been some strings tied onto that. There would have been some strings. And the way it is now, we're totally free of strings. We're self-supporting through our own contribution. Another one of those beautiful little miracles. Well, Betty and I drove Dad back to Vermont for one more time. So it's home, and I wouldn't take for the caring and sharing that we did as we rode along the highway and sitting on the side of the bed at night. And I brought him back to Akron, Ohio. And I had a flying job out of Dallas at the time. That's how I met Creighton. And I never saw my dad alive again. We were living our own life there in Texas. And, but I wouldn't take for that time we had. Then Bill invited Betty and I to come to the Second International in 1955 in St. Louis. And this is the one where Bill turned AA over to the AAs. And this is another very, very important milestone. If you've studied the history of the group and other attempts to sober up people, two things usually happen. They didn't have any structure. We have structure. We've got the 12 steps. We've got the 12 traditions. We've got the 12 concept. And another thing that happened in these earlier attempts, either the guy that started it either died or moved away and the meeting stopped. Well, in this 1955, Bill turned AA over to the AAs with provision that there was a central office that could continue running it after they were gone, because they realized these founders were mortal. That is another beautiful miracle, and I think that's one of the things that kept it going 68 years. My wife and I were party animals. We loved to dance and we loved to drink, and I wasn't telling anybody my father was Dr. Bob Smith. But occasionally they'd find out about it and invite us to a meeting. Yeah. And we would go and have a good time. And on the way home, we'd say, oh, good for them. They needed that. And all the while, alcoholism was working in our family. Betty had poured her dad out into a drying out place in Denver in 1944, and he and another guy started AA in New Mexico. So if there was ever two human beings that should have recognized alcoholism, it was Betty and me. But we didn't. You see, we were different. Do any of you ever think you were different? And we didn't just jump right into AA. You know, our alcoholism for us was three sections. Fun and problems. And we were well into the problem part. And we didn't say, oh, boy. This is going to be, we'll realize, the goal of a lifetime. Betty, you're going to join AA, and I'm going to join Al-Anon. We didn't have any such an idea as that. We kept trying to change it up a little bit and make it work. And let me tell you a little story I love to tell about two hunters that love to hunt way up in the wilds of Alaska. And they would hire an aviation company to fly them into a lake and leave them and then pick them up a week later. And the plane came in, landed on the lake, and one of the hunters said, oh, we're glad to see you. We've had a wonderful hunt. We got three moose. And the pilot said, you two guys, me, and three moose in this little airplane? I don't think so. And one of the hunters said, no, I don't think anything about it. Said a guy came in with a plane just exactly like yours last year, and we had three moose. And what he did was he taxied up the river and got a longer takeoff run across the lake. We didn't have any trouble getting in the air. So the pilot thought, well, I'm new with the company. I guess I got to try this. And so he did. And sure enough, takes off and they start back to civilization. Well, the little engine is working so hard that it begins to overheat. It loses power and then way out in the middle of nowhere it crashes. Well, one of the hunters pulls his buddy up from under the plane. His buddy looked around and said, oh, my gosh, where in the world are we? The other said, you know, I think we're within 100 yards of where we crashed last year. And that was us trying the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. When it got bad enough, Betty took off with her AA program. She quit cold turkey, hanging on by her fingernails. She said, "I don't recommend you do it that way, but I'll tell you one thing, you won't forget it." And she was running off and leaving me. She was working her program to the best of ability and leaving me in the dust. And I thought, I believe I'd like some of that too. So someone said, "Well, Bob, why don't you go to Al-Anon?" And I thought, oh, I don't mind joining the auxiliary. So I got in my car and I drove 40 miles over to east to Gainesville, Texas, my first Al-Anon meeting. And I walk in there and I look around. It's a room full of women. I'm the only guy. Well, I got mixed emotions about Al-Anon immediately. I like to describe mixed emotions this way. It's kind of like the feeling you have when your teenage daughter comes in at 4 in the morning with a Gideon Bible under her arm. But anyway, I stayed, and I bless those ladies. That's still my home group. And they stayed with me until I finally developed a little program myself. Oh, where do you suppose they got these ideas? Have you ever thought about this? Another little miracle. Bill in New York City and my dad and mom in Akron, Ohio, had belonged to an organization called the Oxford Group. Now, this is before they'd even met, but they both had belonged to this particular organization, and it was the Oxford Group was started by a Lutheran minister from Pennsylvania by the name of Frank Buckman, and the basic principles of it were back to first century spirituality. They had meetings, they shared with each other, they moved to other people's meetings, joined other people's meetings. They had many, many things that were incorporated in our program. They had the four absolutes, as you saw: absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute purity of thought, and absolute love that were woven into our program. They had a form of a fifth step. They would take a new guy upstairs in one of the bedrooms of T. Williams Henry's house and bore in on him till he admitted what his problem was. And so we owe those people a tremendous debt of gratitude, but it was also inevitable that we part. You see, the Oxford Group catered to the upper middle class, and the early alcoholics were not upper middle class. The Oxford Group wanted publicity, and the alcoholics already had all the publicity they wanted. And the alcoholics, Oxford Group also had this form of a fifth step, which is open confession and not acceptable to people of the Catholic faith. And I don't know if you folks realize it, but there are Catholics that drink too much. But anyway, it was inevitable that we separate. But we owe those people a tremendous debt of gratitude. Then God has his own big book. And there were certain parts of God's big book, the Holy Bible, that were used. The 13th Corinthians, the Sermon on the Mount, and as you all know, the book of James, which is faith without works is dead. And these are the things that have been woven in to make our program. And folks, these are spiritual programs. It's not a spiritual part. They're holy, holy, entirely spiritual. And if you don't have the spirituality of the program, I don't think you've got a program. These were entirely spiritual, but anyhow, our Heavenly Father somehow saw to it that the thing was put together and lasted, and miracles. Let me talk to you about a couple of money. Bill and Dad were broke, and they thought, oh boy, wouldn't it be great if we had some money for this wonderful movement. They're human beings, you know. So they went to New York City, as you saw in the film, Mr. Rockefeller's group listened very, very carefully and said, no, money will ruin it. Now think what would have happened in your mind's eye if Mr. Rockefeller and his group had dumped $1 million on 100 broke alcoholics. I bet we wouldn't be sitting there tonight. They'd be still fighting over it. Anonymity. In the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, there were people with huge egos. Now, I know we don't have any of that anymore. But the beauty is, you can't be Mr. A or Mrs. Al-Anon if nobody knows what your name is. And another thing that has done, folks, it doesn't make any difference if you've been here 40 days or 40 years. We are all exactly the same. And isn't that the way it should be? Miracle. God, as we understood him, was incorporated into the steps. I think as a result of some of my mom infusion of her spiritual notebook, and that was Dr. Sam Shoemaker's, his too. But what that one little phrase has done, folks, that has allowed these movements to be acceptable all over the world. People who have an entirely different concept of higher power, perhaps you and me. Perfectly acceptable. Just those words. God as we understood him. And that's a miracle. The big book of AA. You know, when it first came out, they couldn't give it away. It was in a bonded warehouse. And the guy that ran the warehouse wouldn't let any books out until they had the cash. So they'd get 25 and go sell them and then come back and get 35. And it was just, nobody bought the thing. It was just a drug on the market. Now I understand it's the second bestseller of all time. I don't know how it is here, but you can't even buy one at a bookstore in Texas. Isn't that a miracle? And the first 164 pages are exactly the same as they were when they were first written, except for one word. You know, Bill had a spiritual experience. It had come on him as a light. And most of us don't get it that way. Most of us, we have to work at it. So they changed that one word from having had a spiritual experience to having had a spiritual what? Awakening. And that's a change. And think of the millions and millions of alcoholics that have tried to find a loophole in those first 164 pages. Miracle. Oh, the program, you know, personally in my program, so many beautiful benefits. God. I was raised in the Episcopalian Church. That's Catholic light. You know, all the pageantry without the guilt, yeah. And God was used to improve my conduct. You know, he was up there circling around, and if I screwed up, he was going to zap me. Well, that wasn't a very adult thing when I grew up. So I discarded that. I was a bomber pilot in World War II. I flew 45 missions out of Africa, an old four-engine Liberator. Yeah. And my whole crew was killed. We carried a 10-man crew, and I was the flight leader of the lead flight, and the squadron commander called me in one day and said, Bob, one of your pilots is having trouble. Ride with him. See if you can help him. I'll take your crew out tonight. And he took my crew out, and they were jumped by 5 Ju-88s, and they never came back. I'm the only survivor of that crew. Well, I really wanted to live. And I had what I call a 911 relationship with God. I made deals with God. Did any of you ever try to do that? Oh, God, if you get me out of this, I swear. You know, can you imagine all the arrogance making a deal with God? Well, that didn't work either. And now I have in my life a loving God. We're all God's kids. He's my heavenly Father. I thank him every night. I pray to him every day. I talk to him just like I can talk to you. As I drive down the highway, God, did you see that SOB cut us off? What a beautiful, beautiful relationship. Miracle. Honesty. I always thought I was honest. Cash register honest. You know, a girl give me too much change, I'd say, oh, here, you gave me a quarter too much, and I just feel blissfully honest all day long. Then there's another stage of honesty, and that's what I call resume honesty. That's when you basically tell the truth, but you gussy it up so people will like you or they'll hire you. Now, in our program, there is rigorous honesty. And when I can show you me, warts and all, and you do the same for me, we can have an instant, intimate friendship. And I know of no other programs in the world that you can do that. And what that does for me, and I assume for you, it dispels loneliness. Miracle. Freedom. You know, I think when we get here, we have a freedom. Do any of you remember that old country and western song, Me and Bobby McGee? You know, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. And nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free. That's kind of where we are here. Then when we work our program, I think we get to the turning point. And we have another, for the first time, we are free. We are free to make choices. We can make good choices, we can make bad choices, but we can make choices. And that's a beautiful freedom. And my sponsor has told me about another one that I've been working on. And every morning I get up and I say, okay, God, you're the in-house manager. You're running it. I'll do the legwork. You do whatever needs to be done and tell me what you want me to do. And that's another level of freedom, another beautiful plus in a program. Well, it was going along beautifully well. My wife was attending AA and I was attending Al-Anon, and we got a phone call. Our oldest son, Scott, who had a master's degree cum laude from the University of Texas, was a member of Mensa, didn't have a problem with drugs or booze, went to work there in Dallas. He was a top BMW salesman in Dallas. Something happened, went out in his car and sat down, took his gun, blew his brains out. Terrible. Just a terrible shock to us. No parent wants to outlive their children. But the point I want to make is that the program and the people in it took us in hand and propped us up until we could stand alone. 6 months later, my beautiful wife, Betty, came down with terminal cancer and passed away. And again, the group and the people in it took me in their arms and propped me up until I was able to stand alone again. And I tell you this because some of these things will happen to you. May have already, but if you live long enough, this is life on life's terms, folks. But this is another plus, a beautiful plus of our programs. My God does not slam one door, but what he opens, another one. And I got to tell you about this. I found another lady. She's old. She's programmed. She's been the Al-Anon delegate from Mississippi. And she's 26 years sober in AA. And we've been married 7 months. When we went down to get the license, the clerk was waiting on the young couple, and she looked it up and said, well, you two are old enough to know better than this. But anyway, we're starting a beautiful life together. And again, my God has been so gracious and so generous. And I know he will for you. Your miracles, if you haven't had them yet, They're coming. Just hang in there with us. Work your program to the best of ability. And don't you quit before your miracle. Thank you very, very much.